Chapter 7 Junkyard of Dreams. Mental geographies betray class prejudice. In the trendy chic LA Weekly's Best of Los Angeles guide, one of the 10 best of the best is the Robertson Boulevard off-ramp of the Santa Monica Freeway near Beverly Hills, where the air starts to clear of smog and the true heaven of the West Side begins. In yuppie deli map consciousness, landscapes tend to compress logarithmically as soon as one leaves the terrain of luxury lifestyles. Thus, Fairfax is the near east side, while downtown is the far horizon, surrounded by dimly known zones of ethnic restaurants. Even if the West Sider is vaguely familiar with the old concentrations of WASP wealth marooned in Pasadena, Claremont, or Redlands, the eastbound San Bernardino Freeway, the I-10, traversed at warp speed with the windows rolled up against the smog and dust, is merely the high road to Palm Springs in the Arizona desert. The inland empire of western San Bernardino and Riverside counties is little more than a blur. One of the few modern writers to venture thither, Joan Didion, on her way to a San Bernardino murder trial, found the landscape curious and unnatural. The lemon groves are sunken down a 3 or 4 foot retaining wall, so that one looks directly into their dense foliage, too lush, unsettlingly glossy, the greenery of nightmare. The fallen eucalyptus bark is too dusty, a place for snakes to breed. The stones look not like natural stones, but like the rubble of some unmentioned catastrophe. Rising from the geological and social detritus that has accumulated at the foot of the Cajon Pass, 60 miles east of Los Angeles, the city of Fontana is the principal byproduct of this unmentioned catastrophe. A gritty blue-collar town well known to line-haul truckers everywhere, with rusting blast furnaces and outlaw motorcycle gangs, the birthplace of the Hells Angels in 1946, it is the regional antipode of the sumptuary belts of West L.A. or Orange County. Designer living here means a Peterbilt with a custom sleeper or a full chrome Harley Hog, a loud brawling mosaic of working-class cultures. Black, Italian, hillbilly, Slovene, and Chicano, Fontana has long endured an unsavory reputation in the eyes of San Bernardino County's moral crusaders and middle-class boosters. But Fontana is more than merely the roughest town in the county. Its indissoluble toughness of character is the product of an extraordinary, deeply emblematic local history. Over the course of the 75 years since its founding, Fontana has been both junkyard and utopia for successive tropes of changing California dream. The millions of tourists and commuters who annually pass by Fontana on I-10, occasionally peeking into the shabbiness of its backyards and derelict orchards, can little imagine the hopes and visions shipwrecked here. In its original early 20th century incarnation, Fontana was the modernized Jeffersonian idyll, an Arcadian community of small chicken ranchers and citrus growers living self-sufficiently in their electrified bungalows. Then in 1942, the community was abruptly reshaped to accommodate the dream of a Rooseveltian industrial revolution in the West. The Promethean energies of Henry Kaiser turned Fontana overnight into a mighty forge for war, the only integrated steel complex on the Pacific slope. In the early 1980s, with equally brutal swiftness, the mill town was shuttered and its workers and machines reduced to scrap. Yet, Phoenix-like, a third Fontana, the affordable suburb, has arisen from the ruins of Kaisertown. In the new economic geometry of the Southern California Metro C, where increasing masses commute 3 or more hours daily to reconcile paychecks with mortgages, Fontana and its sister communities of San Bernardino County's West End are the new dormitories of Southern California's burgeoning workforces. If violent instability in local landscape and culture is taken to be constitutive of Southern California's peculiar social ontology, then Fontana epitomizes the region. It is an imagined community, twice invented and promoted, then turned inside out to become once again a visionary green field. Its repeated restructurings have traumatically registered the shifting interaction of regional and international, manufacturing and real estate, capitalism. Yet despite the claims of some theorists of the hyper-real or the depthless present, the past is not completely erasable, even in Southern California. Steelmaking in the shadow of the San Bernardinos, the transposed culture of Pennsylvania millworkers on a horticultural semi-utopia on the edge of the desert, have left human residues that defy the most determined efforts of current developers to repackage Fontana as a vacant lot. To this extent, the Fontana story provides a parable. It is about the fate of those suburbanized California working classes who cling to their tarnished dreams at the far edge of the LA galaxy. Fontana Farms. It was just the type of place they often had talked of, 10 acres of level land, rich, fertile. On it were 200 fine walnut trees, young but sturdy, and on four sides was a beautiful fringe of tall, graceful eucalypti, through which they glimpsed the lofty crests of the San Bernardinos. It would be wonderful if we just had money enough, said she. At least, said he, we have enough to make a start. We can pay down what we can spare and stay in the city for a while. There'll be enough to put up a little garage house, and we'll have a place of our own to come to weekends and holidays. And so, much sooner than they had hoped, their dream of a place all their own, out in the country, came true. Every weekend, every holiday found them on their Fontana farm, planting things, cultivating their walnut trees, watching things grow. And their farm returned their affection in full measure. Never did the walnut trees thrive so. Never did berry bushes and fruit trees do better. Each week they carried back with them some of the products of their farm. Then there came a day when they could build the farm home they always had planned, a roomy, rambling house with a world of windows, a broad green lawn and trees in front, and at the back equipment for 2,000 chickens, a rabbitry for 240 full-blooded New Zealand whites, and just for the fun of it, pens for Muscovy and Peking ducks, turkeys. And so the first of the year they moved in. Each week brings an egg check of $40 to $50 or more. There is a ready market for every rabbit they can produce. The walnut trees will be in production soon, and in full bearing they will add another $2,000 per year net to the profits of the place. In all Fontana, there's no farm that's finer, no couple that is happier, and it's proved so easy after they found their Fontana farm. Fontana Farms ad, 1930. Fontana Farms was the brainchild of A.B. Miller, San Bernardino contractor and agriculturalist. All but forgotten today, Miller was one of the hero builders of a unique civilization of affluent agricultural colonies in what was once known as the Valley of the South, stretching from Pomona to Redlands. Like the more widely known George Chaffee, whose Ontario colony had decisive influence on the technology of Zionist settlement in Palestine, Miller was a visionary entrepreneur of hydroelectric power, irrigated horticulture, cooperative marketing, and planned community development, which is to say he was a brilliant real estate promoter who fully grasped the combination of advertising and infrastructure required to alchemize the dusty plains of the San Bernardinos into gold. If Chaffee, along with L.A. water titan William Mulholland, far surpassed the hydraulic accomplishments of Miller, the latter was unique in the thorough planning and complementary agricultural diversity that made Fontana such a striking realization of the petty bourgeois ideal of withdrawal into Jeffersonian autonomy. Only the failed socialist utopia of Llano del Rio in the Mojave Desert north of Los Angeles aspired to a more ambitious integration of civility and self-sufficiency. In 1906, Miller, flush with construction profits from the new Imperial Valley, took over the failed promotion of the Semi-Tropic Land and Water Company, 28 square miles of boulder-strewn plain west of San Bernardino. Incessantly raked by dust storms and desiccating Santa Ana winds, the alluvial Fontana Cucamonga fan, for the most part, retained the same forlorn aspect, greasewood, sage, and scattered wild plum trees, that had greeted the original Mormon colonists sent by Brigham Young in 1851 to establish San Bernardino as Deseret's window on the Pacific. Raising capital from prominent Los Angeles bankers, Miller undertook the construction of a vast irrigation system, tapping the snows of Mount Baldy via Little Creek, and the planting of 500,000 eucalyptus saplings as windbreaks. By 1913, his Fontana Company was ready to begin laying out a town site between Foothill Boulevard, an old wagon road soon to become part of famous U.S. 66, and the Santa Fe tracks. At the inaugural barbecue, Miller's friend and sponsor, Pacific Electric Railroad President Paul Shoup, promised that his red cars would soon bring thousands of day trippers and prospective homesteaders to see the future at work in Fontana. Other famous irrigation colonies of the day, Pasadena, Ontario, Redlands, and so on, thrived by franchising citrus growing as an investment haven for wealthy sun-seeking Easterners. The cooperative Sunkist model, later so influential in shaping Herbert Hoover's vision of self-organized capitalism, provided newcomers with a network of production services, a coordinated labor pool, and a national marketing organization with a common trademark. On the other hand, the Arcadian life of a Southern California orange, lemon, or avocado grower required substantial startup capital, at least $40,000 in 1919, and outside income to sustain the operator until his trees became fruit-bearing. Ready access to capital was also necessary to tide growers over between the seasons and periodically to absorb the costs of crop-killing frosts. Seduced by the siren song of fabulous profits in the foothills, thousands of undercapitalized citrus ranchers lost their life savings in a few seasons. Miller's concept of Fontana was presented as an alternative to aristocratic citrus colonies like Redlands, as well as to the more speculative settlements in the eastern San Gabriel Valley. Fontana was envisioned as an unprecedented combination of industrialized plantation, Fontana Farms, and Jeffersonian small holdings, subdivided by Fontana Land Company. Fontana Farms was a futuristic example of vertically integrated, scientifically managed corporate agriculture. Its primary input was the city of Los Angeles' garbage, which from 1921 to 1950 it received in daily gondola car shipments by rail. The garbage contract was so lucrative that Miller was forced to make large payoffs to corrupt city councilmen, igniting a 1931 municipal scandal. The 500 or 600 daily tons of garbage fattened the 60,000 hogs that made Fontana Farms the largest such operation in the world. When the hogs reached full weight, they were shipped back to Los Angeles for slaughter, recycled garbage thus providing perhaps a quarter of the region's ham and bacon. The coincident accumulation of manure was no less valued. It was either utilized as fertilizer for Miller's citrus grove, also the world's largest, or peddled to neighboring ranchers. Fontana Farms even made a small profit reselling the silverware it reclaimed from restaurant garbage. Meanwhile, the Fontana Company was busy subdividing the rest of the Miller Empire into model small farms. With an enthusiasm for mass marketing and production that clearly prefigured Henry Kaiser's, Miller aimed his promotion at precisely that middling mass of would-be rural escapists who had previously been cannon fodder for Southern California's most ill-fated land and oil speculations. His affordable Fontana Farm idol, by contrast, was designed to be assembled on layaway, with combinations of small semi-annual installments and lots of sweat equity. For bare land, prices of $300 to $500, for the minimum 2.5-acre starter farm in 1930, the prospective Fontanan was offered a choice of bearing grapevines or walnut trees. Corporate Fontana Farms maintained a vast nursery of 1 million saplings. Starting with vacation farming on weekends, Los Angeles was only an hour away by automobile or red car, the purchaser would gradually add on living quarters, which the Fontana Farms Company offered in a complete range from weekend cabins to the ultimate charming red-tile Spanish colonial farmhouse. Examples of these are still widely visible throughout Fontana. What was supposed to make the whole endeavor ingeniously self-financing, however, was Miller's formula of combining tree crops, walnuts and mixed citrus, or vineyards, with poultry, supported by cheap inputs from Fontana Farms' industrial economies of scale, fertilizer, saplings, water, and power. Colonists were urged to install chicken coops as soon as possible to generate reliable incomes. This famous partnership of hens and oranges, was intended to stabilize the small tree rancher through the vagaries of frost and cash flow, while simultaneously guaranteeing the Fontana Company its installment payments. Ideally, it was supposed to allow the retired couple with a modest pension, the young family with rustic inclinations, or the hard-working immigrant, the means to achieve a citrus belt lifestyle formerly accessible only to the well-to-do. Miller's dream sold well, even through the early years of the Depression. By 1930, the Fontana Company had subdivided more than 3,000 homesteads, half occupied by full-time settlers, some of them immigrants from Hungary, Yugoslavia, and Italy. The 10 pioneer poultry plants of 1919 had grown to 900, making the district the premier poultry center of the West. Fontana Farms, meanwhile, had expanded to a full-time workforce of 500 Mexican and Japanese laborers, comparable to the largest cotton plantations in the Mississippi Delta. In the early 30s, Miller joined forces with a Swift dynasty from Chicago to buy out the historic Miller, no relation, and Lux cattle empire in the San Joaquin Valley. His rising stature in California agriculture, together with his contributions to making it into a genuine agribusiness, were acknowledged by Republican Governor Rolfe, who appointed Miller president of the State Agricultural Society and ex officio a regent of the University of California. Even if Fontana Farms was ultimately little more than a real estate promotion, cleverly and extravagantly packaged as semi-utopia, it retains considerable historical importance as the most striking Southern California example of the back-to-the-land movement in the interwar years. Originally a yeoman's version of the irrigation colony ideal, exemplified by both Chaffee's Ontario and the socialists' Llano del Rio, Fontana grew to share many of the qualities of Frank Lloyd Wright's Broadacres project and the 1930s anti-urban experiments. Skimming through old advertising brochures for Fontana Farms, one is struck by the ideological congruence, however inadvertent, between Miller's declared aims and the Henry Georgian program which Giorgio Chucci has claimed infused Wright's Broadacres. Labor-saving electrification, the right of the average citizen to the land, the integration of the city and the countryside, cooperation rather than government, and the opportunity for all to be capitalists. If, as Chucci sarcastically observes, Wright's ideal city would be realized only in the grotesque and preposterous form of Disneyland and Disney World, Miller's more practical version of the Broadacre ideal had a brief but real tenure. All the more ironic, then, that pastoral Fontana Farms would be upstaged and eventually uprooted by Henry Kaiser's Satanic Mill. Miracle Man. The Miracle Man Comes to Fontana. 1942 headline. In 1946, after 2 years of crisscrossing all the old 48 states, my ideal day was to spend all morning with the First National Bank and the afternoon with the CIO. John Gunther published Inside USA, his vast 979-page Whitman-esque snapshot of the domestic political scene on the threshold of the post-war era. For Gunther, the most popular journalist of his generation, World War II was comparable to the Revolution or the Civil War as a watershed of American character. From the standpoint of an onrushing American century, he was concerned to distinguish the progressive from the reactionary, the visionary from the backward-looking. Although later journalists, albeit only by team effort, eventually duplicated the scale of his canvas, that is, the entire U.S. political universe, none has ever matched the astuteness or piquancy of his characterizations of an entire generation of public figures. Unsurprisingly, in the gutter bottom of national political life, Gunther identified the representatives of Mississippi, the Hague machine of New Jersey, and other avatars of domestic fascism. Conversely, at the very pinnacle of his new American pantheon, rising above even Governors Warren and Stassen, perennial Gunther favorites, was the most important industrialist in the United States, the builder of Richmond and Fontana, Henry J. Kaiser. 45 years later, with the mighty Kaiser Empire now dismantled, Gunther's panegyric to Kaiser, he was given an entire chapter to himself, requires some explanation. In essence, Gunther, like many contemporary observers, saw Kaiser as the exemplary incarnation of the Rooseveltian synthesis of free enterprise and enlightened state intervention. Kaiser of the 1930s and 1940s is heroically entrepreneurial. Gunther compares him to 19th century empire builders like the Central Pacific's Big Four. Yet unlike the old-fashioned railroad corsairs, Kaiser has great social consciousness and conscience. A lifelong registered Republican, he avidly supports the New Deal. As to labor, Kaiser's friendly relations are well known. He wants to be able to calculate his costs to the last inch, and he never budges without a labor contract. Although his early background was as a small-town salesman, lacking any formal training in engineering or manufacturing, Kaiser, by the mid-1940s, had become the great problem-solving magician of the war economy, mass-producing Liberty ships in 4 days, and achieving other productivist feats worthy of Edison or Ford. Even better than Ford himself, who represented an earlier era of authoritarian engineer capitalism, Kaiser personified the spirit of the war-generated high-productivity, high-wage economy that later economic historians would refer to as Fordism. But Kaiserism would have been a more apt name for the post-war social contract between labor and management. Production, in the last analysis, depends on the will of labor to produce. You can't have healthy and viable industry without first a healthy labor movement, and second, social insurance, community health, hospitalization plans, and decent housing. To break a union is to break yourself. The Kaiser Credo. Kaiser was also a hero of the West. Denounced by Wall Street as the economic antichrist and coddled New Deal pet, he was welcomed west of the Rockies as a self-made frontier capitalist who, against incredible odds, had triumphed over William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold. To Western economic nationalists like A.J. Masaryk, Kaiser was a new kind of industrialist, an incarnation of the trust-busting Second New Deal, and a pioneer of the independent industrialization of the West. In fact, Kaiser, accumulating a small fortune in the corrupt street-paving business during the auto-crazy 1920s, was transformed into an industrial giant during the 1930s by virtue of strategic and sometimes secretive business and political alliances. In the late 1920s, Kaiser became a favorite of the legendary Amadeo Giannini, founder of the Bank of Italy, later Bank of America, and the West's major independent financier. With Giannini backing, Kaiser assumed de facto leadership over the coalition of construction companies building Hoover Dam and became the six companies' Washington lobbyist. In the Capitol, Kaiser hired consummate New Deal fixer, Tommy Corcoran, to represent his interests in the White House, while cultivating his own special relationship to powerful Interior Secretary Harold Ickes. Most importantly, Kaiser, together with Giannini and other local allies, were able to recognize the extraordinary window of opportunity for Western economic development opened up by the political crisis of the First New Deal in 1935-6. To be fair, it was actually Herbert Hoover, the first president from California, who had launched the industrialization of the Pacific Slope by authorizing construction of both the Hoover Dam and the Golden Gate Bridge. But the big chance for Western and Southern businessmen came in the interregnum between the Banking Act of 1935 and the beginning of Lend-Lease, when relations between the White House and Wall Street reached their 20th century nadir. As Eastern finance capital, including many key supporters of FDR in 1933, turned against the New Deal, Kaiser and Giannini, together with Texas oil independents and Mormon bankers, led by six companies' partner and new Federal Reserve Chairman Mariner Eccles, politically and financially shored up the Roosevelt administration, preventing the insurgent labor movement from dominating the National Democratic Party. In his epic Age of Roosevelt, Arthur Schlesinger describes the convergence of interests that supported the second antitrust New Deal of the late 1930s. It included representatives of the new money of the South and West, like Jesse Jones, Henry J. Kaiser, and A.P. Giannini, who were in revolt against the rentier mentality of New York and wanted government to force down interest rates and even supply capital for local development. It included representatives of new industries like communications and electronics, including Hollywood. It included representatives of business, particularly dependent on consumer demand, like Sears Roebuck, and it included speculators like Joseph P. Kennedy, who invested in both new regions and new industries. The modern Sun Belt was largely born out of the political rewards of the Second New Deal coalition. Billions of dollars in federal aid, representing net tax transfers from the rest of the country, laid down an industrial infrastructure in California, Washington, and Texas, and nearly $110 million in major construction contracts, including the Bay Bridge, the naval base on Mare Island, and Bonneville, Grand Coulee, and Shasta Dams, fueled the breakneck expansion of the Kaiser Company. Long before Pearl Harbor, Kaiser was already discussing with Giannini and a select group of Western industrialists, Donald Douglas, Stephen Bechtel, and John McCone, strategies for maximizing the role of local capital in a war economy. Recognizing that a Pacific war would make unprecedented demands on the under-industrialized California economy, Kaiser proposed to adapt Detroit's assembly line methods to revolutionize the construction of merchant shipping. Although critics initially scoffed at the idea that a mere sand and gravel man could master the art of shipbuilding, Kaiser, with the support of his high-level New Deal connections, became the biggest shipbuilder in American history. In 4 years, his giant Richmond, Portland, and Vancouver, Washington, yards launched a third of the American Merchant Navy, 80% of Liberty ships, as well as 50 baby flat-top aircraft carriers, nearly 1,500 vessels in all. In Richmond, where 747 ships were built, Kaiser was able to create a social and technological template for post-war capitalism. To simplify welding, huge deck houses were assembled upside down and then hoisted into place, helping reduce the traditional 6-month shipbuilding cycle to a week. In the absence of a skilled labor force, Kaiser trained something like 300,000 welders at Richmond alone, out of soda jerks and housewives. But his real genius was the systematic attention he focused on maintaining labor at high productivity with minimum time lost to sickness or turnover, the nightmares of other military contractors. Back in 1938, while trying to meet deadlines on the Grand Coulee, Kaiser experimented with transforming indirect medical costs into a direct calculable industrial input by subscribing his workers to the prepaid health plan engineered by Dr. Sidney Garfield. This Permanente health plan, to be the most enduring part of the Kaiser legacy, was adapted with union collaboration to the massive Richmond workforce, together with active company intervention to construct war housing, organize recreation, and rationalize overloaded public transport. Kaiser imported cars from the old 6th Avenue L in New York. But Kaiser's Richmond shipyards had a critical bottleneck, a persistent shortage of steel plate. An industrial colony of the East, the West Coast had always imported steel at high markups, $6 to $20 per ton. Now, in the midst of a superheated war economy, the Eastern mills could not supply, nor could the railroads transport enough of this high-cost steel to meet the demands of Pacific shipyards. Although U.S. Steel's Benjamin Fairless claimed that abstract economic justice no more demands that the Pacific Coast have a great steel industry than that New York grow its own oranges, the war shortage prompted the corporation to propose a new integrated ore-to-steel mill on a Utah coal field. Arguing, however, that the post-war Western market would not justify the extra capacity added by the mill, U.S. Steel demanded that the Defense Production Corporation pay the cost of construction. Kaiser countered with his own characteristically audacious proposal to borrow the money from the government to build on his own account a Tidewater steel complex in the Los Angeles area, using Boulder, Hoover, Dam power. From the outset, this was treated by all sides as a Western declaration of independence from Big Steel, provoking rage in Pittsburgh in equal measure to the enthusiasm it generated in California. In the event, Washington tried to satisfy all sides by allowing U.S. Steel to operate the government-built mill in Geneva, Utah, while loaning $110 million to Kaiser via the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. The War Department, however, whether acting from post-Pearl Harbor hysteria or secretly lobbied by Big Steel, as Mazarek believed, insisted that the Kaiser facility had to be located at least 50 miles inland, away from possible Japanese air attack. This locational constraint was widely thought to preclude post-war conversion of the facility to competitive production, Rule of thumb wisdom held that an integrated complex could only operate at a profit if dependence on rail transport was confined to one leg of its logistical tripod of iron ore, coking coal, and steel product. A Southern California Tidewater plant was accorded but a slim chance of survival in the post-war market. An inland location, dependent upon coal and iron rail shipments from hundreds of miles away, was considered an economic impossibility. But Kaiser believed that problems were only opportunities with their work clothes on, and refused to be daunted. He calculated that radical economies in steelmaking and mining technology, together with a vast promise of the post-war California market, drastically underestimated by Big Steel, would allow him to convert profitably to peacetime production. Accepting the War Department's disadvantageous conditions, he sent his engineers in search of a suitable inland location. They quickly fixed their sights on Fontana. The Deluxe War Baby. From pigs to pig iron, Fontana Steel will build a new world. Kaiser slogans, 1940s. In that Indian summer before Pearl Harbor, Fontana's destiny seemed fixed forever on hogs, eggs, and citrus. While locals debated the hot prospects in the annual Hen Derby, or fretted over rising mortality on Death Alley, Valley Boulevard, Fontana Farms publicists were boasting that the 1940 census proves Fontana top agricultural community in the United States. A.B. Miller, now in partnership with Giant Swift and Company, waxed more powerful than ever in state agribusiness circles and conservative inland empire politics. Then, with chilling punctuality, death struck down Fontana's founders. Miller, April 1941, followed within months by leading businessman Charles Hoffman, water system founder William Stale, and Fontana Farms citrus director J.A. McGregor. With the passing of the pioneer generation and the growing awareness that California would soon become the staging ground for a vast Pacific War, boosters in spring 1941 began a xenophobic promotion of Fontana as an ideal location for war industry. Miller's Fontana Farm successor, R.E. Boyle, joined local supervisor C.E. Greer and Congressman Henry Shepard in cajoling Fontanans into accepting that their patriotic duty, based on real American principles, was to create the new partnership of agriculture and war industry. But 6 months of aggressive advertising and patriotic bombast yielded not a single munitions plant or aircraft factory. Instead, the hysteria that followed Pearl Harbor, when Japanese aircraft were daily sighted over Long Beach and Hollywood, prompted a rush for safe inland residences. In the early weeks of 1942, Fontana Farms was selling 2 ranches per day to anxious refugees from Los Angeles. Even Supervisor Greer, chief advocate of the military industrialization of the Inland Empire, was forced to admit that Fontana would contribute, in great measure, to winning the war by the productivity of its poultry. Then came the great bolt from Kaiser headquarters in Oakland. Prevented from building at Tidewater, Kaiser was attracted to Fontana for 2 different reasons. On the one hand, his engineers and their military counterparts added up the ready-made advantages of Miller's infrastructural investments: cheap power from Little Creek, now augmented by Boulder Dam, excellent rail connections near 2 major rail yards, San Bernardino and Colton, and most importantly, in a semi-desert, an autonomous low-cost water supply. The weak claims of local government over the unincorporated Fontana area were also considered an asset. San Bernardino was a poor rural county with an unusually large relief load, and Kaiser clearly preferred to deal with, and if necessary, overawe and intimidate, its unsophisticated officials, desperate for any type of industrial investment, than face more powerful and self-confident public bureaucracies elsewhere. On the other hand, Kaiser was personally captivated by Miller's utopia. As in Richmond, he placed social engineering on par with the priorities of production engineering, figuring that hens and citrus might mitigate the class struggle. He saw advantages to building in a rural community. Workers at the steel mill had the opportunity to raise chickens on the side or plant gardens. Kaiser believed these hobby farms created a more relaxed atmosphere, and the workers would be more content. It was something that could not be found in the eastern steel towns, and therefore a comparative advantage. On the first anniversary of A.B. Miller's interment, Kaiser broke ground on a former Miller ranch a few miles west of Fontana Township, his bulldozers literally chasing the hogs away. Under the supervision of veterans of Grand Coulee and Richmond, the construction shock brigades made breathtaking progress. By the 30th of December 1942, the acrid smell of coke smoke hung over the citrus groves, and as local radio announcer Chet Huntley officiated, Mrs. Henry J. Kaiser threw the switch that fired the giant 1,200-ton blast furnace named in her honor, Big Bess. An even more elaborate ceremony in May 1943 celebrated the tapping of the first steel. Surrounded by Hollywood stars and top military brass, Kaiser, with typical bravado, announced that Fontana was the beginning of the Pacific era and a great industrial empire for the West. Fleets of diesel trucks began the long shuttle of Fontana-made plate to the steel-hungry shipyards of Richmond and San Pedro. The vast mile-square plant, Southern California's deluxe war baby, seemed to erupt out of the earth before Fontanans had a chance to weigh the impact on their small rural society. Perhaps because of the rapidity of the transition, or because of patriotic consensus, there was no recorded protest against the plant construction. Kaiser's spokesman reassured residents that the plant could be erected in the middle of an orange grove and operated continuously without the slightest damage to trees. By the end of the first year, however, disturbing evidence to the contrary had become obvious. The coking coal first employed at Fontana had high sulfur content, producing acidic vapors that withered saplings and burnt the leaves off trees. Ranchers across from the mill picked grapefruit from their trees for the last time in the fall of 1942. This was the beginning of the end of Miller's Eden, as well as the start of a regional pollution problem of major proportions. While Fontanans were watching their trees die, Kaiser was shattering the illusion of starry-eyed San Bernardino County supervisors that the plant would be an enormous tax windfall. Assessed at normal rates in July 1943, the company rejected the county's bill out of hand, warning that they might be forced to close the plant. Although reporters scoffed at the obviously absurd threat to shutter the brand-new $110 million mill, overawed supervisors obediently reduced the assessment to a small fraction of the original. Their concession set a precedent that allowed Kaiser officials to protest any prospective tax increase as undercutting the economic viability of the plant. As a result, San Bernardino County saw its major potential tax resource evolve into a net tax liability, a fact that helps explain official apathy to the plant's closure a generation later. As the experts had foreseen, the major difficulty in producing steel in Fontana was the organization of raw material supply. Kaiser could purchase limestone and dolomite flux from local quarries, but it had no alternative but to develop its own network of captive mines to source iron and coal. Although geologists reassured Kaiser that the nearby Mojave Desert contained enough iron ore within a 300-mile radius to supply the plant for several centuries, exploitation of the richest deposits required costly investments in rail laying and mining technology. Initially, Fontana was supplied with ore from the Vulcan mine near Kelso. After the war, the company developed the Great Eagle Mountain Complex in Riverside County, with its own rail line and mining workforce of 500. Coking coal, the most difficult supply variable, had to be imported 800 miles from Price, Utah. In 1960, Kaiser Fontana switched to new mines in New Mexico. Overall, Fontana was refining low-cost iron ore with the nation's highest-cost coal, an equation that left its furnace costs well above other integrated mills, including U.S. Steel's coalfield plant in Utah. Despite the burden of these supply costs, Kaiser, by 1944, was making steel more efficiently than anyone had expected to build ships in greater tonnage than anyone had dreamt possible. He was also smelting aluminum, assembling bombers, mixing concrete, even producing the incendiary goop with which the Army Air Corps was systematically immolating Tokyo and Osaka. At the pinnacle of its popularity, he was widely rumored to be Roosevelt's favorite choice for a fourth-term running mate. Meanwhile, his alliance with the New Deal had catapulted the Kaiser companies to the top rank of privately owned firms. And unlike the California aircraft industry, his operations were totally independent of Wall Street and Eastern banks. When he was not borrowing government money, his old ally Giannini made available the Bank of America's largest single line of credit. Buoyed by the successes of his shipyards and steel and aluminum mills, Kaiser surveyed a bold, coordinated expansion into post-war markets for medical care, appliances, housing, aircraft, and automobiles. In his wartime speeches, Kaiser was fond of adding a fifth freedom to Roosevelt's original four, the freedom of abundance. He recognized with singular prescience that the conjuncture of rising Union power, which he supported, and wartime productivity advances, were finally going to unleash the mass consumer revolution that the New Deal had long promised. He also calculated that the pent-up demand for housing and cars, fueled by the fantastic volume of wartime forced savings, created an explosive market situation in which independent entrepreneurs like himself might find the opportunity of the century to compete with the Fortune 500. Everything depended on the speed of reconversion, retooling, and the ability to offer the kind of streamlined products that Americans had been dreaming about since the 1939 New York World's Fair. With characteristic hubris, Henry J. attempted to expand into all markets simultaneously. His venture into experimental aviation was short-lived when he abandoned, to the obsessive Howard Hughes, the further development of their prototype super transport, the notorious Spruce Goose. In the field of mass-produced housing, on the other hand, Kaiser had substantial success. For two decades, he had been building homes for his dam and shipyard workers, even master-planning entire communities. He had also been discussing the national housing crisis with such seminal thinkers as Norman Bel Geddes, the designer of the famous Futurama exhibit at the 1939 World's Fair. Shortly after VJ Day, Kaiser dramatically announced a housing revolution, America's answer to the so-called accomplishments of communists and fascists. Creating a nearly 100-mile plant-to-site assembly line in Southern California, where he predicted that immigration would reach 1 million per year in the immediate post-war period, he launched construction of 10,000 prefabricated homes in the Westchester, North Hollywood, and Panorama City areas. Defying an acute shortage of ordinary building material, Kaiser engineers innovated with fiberglass board, steel, aluminum siding, and sheet gypsum, while applying Richmond methods to train armies of construction workers whom Kaiser promptly unionized. But Kaiser homes, however important in demonstrating the feasibility of post-war merchant home building, were only a sideshow for their master. Henry J.'s real ambition was to challenge the Eastern corporate establishment on its own turf. Unfortunately, he chose to fight Detroit and Pittsburgh at the same time, tilting at the most dangerous and dramatic of American windmills. He launched Kaiser Fraser Motors in a giant reconverted bomber plant in Willow Run, Michigan. Simultaneously, he brought Fontana Steel into direct competition with Big Steel for control of Western markets. Only one capitalist from the West ever attempted such a brazen invasion of the East, Giannini, in the late 1920s. For the impudence of staking a seat on Wall Street, Giannini was temporarily deposed in his own house. As J.P. Morgan mounted a retaliatory raid on Transamerica, the Giannini Bank Holding Company. As a Morgan director told Giannini, right or wrong, you do as you're told down here. It was poetic justice, therefore, that Giannini was allied to Kaiser's post-war schemes, introducing him to Joseph Fraser, the rebel Detroit capitalist, as well as supporting the campaign to refinance Fontana Steel. The debacle of Kaiser Fraser has been recently retold in Mark Foster's scholarly biography of Henry J. Fearing post-war layoffs as well as an anti-union backlash by the major automakers, the United Auto Workers had begged Kaiser to convert the Willow Run assembly lines, scheduled for closure after VJ Day, to auto production. Teamed up with Fraser, the former head of Willis Overland, and cheered on by the unions, Kaiser and his engineers tried to duplicate the miracle of Richmond. Within a year of taking over Willow Run, they had built 100,000 cars and recruited an impressive national network of dealerships. The 1947 Kaiser-Fraser shockwave rattled nerves in the executive suites of Dearborn Park and the Chrysler Building. But endemically undercapitalized in face of the auto majors' billion-dollar plant expansions and model changes, the new company sank deep into the red. In the meantime, Giannini had died, Wall Street had boycotted Kaiser's offerings, and Fraser had resigned. After the failure of a last-ditch remodeling in 1954-5, Willow Run was sold off to General Motors, and the dies were shipped to South America, where Kaiser body cars were still being assembled as late as the 1970s. Although Kaiser continued for another decade to build Jeeps at his Willis Overland subsidiary in Toledo, the Western invasion of Detroit was over. Fontana, by contrast, was an untrammeled success, despite bitter opposition from Big Steel and comparable financial problems to Kaiser Frazier's. In the immediate reconversion period of steel shortages and turbulent industrial relations, 1945-6, Kaiser's friendship with the CIO exempted Fontana from the bitter national steel strike. Expanding into new product markets, especially construction, Kaiser Steel strained at capacity during the steel drought, even briefly exporting to Europe. But once the steel strike was settled and capacity began to adjust to demand, Fontana's inherent logistical and financial problems seemed to signal doom. Fortunately, Kaiser metallurgists produced the kind of technical breakthrough at Fontana that eluded the design teams at Willow Run. Just as Henry J. had brashly promised, his engineers offset their high coal costs by radically reducing coke loads and increasing blast furnace efficiency. Similarly, at Eagle Mountain, Kaiser mining engineers pioneered new economies in ore extraction, reducing their iron costs even further below Eastern averages. By the mid-1950s, Fontana was an international benchmark of advanced steelmaking, keenly studied by steelmasters from Japan and other high raw material cost countries. A more intractable problem was repaying the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, RFC, loan that had built Fontana. With Congress recaptured by the Republicans in 1946 and his New Deal allies leaving the Truman administration in droves, Kaiser was politically isolated. Under fire in Congress for alleged profiteering on his wartime shipbuilding contracts, a calumny, he charged, that was spread by his Eastern corporate enemies, he was unable to persuade the RFC to discount or refinance any of his 1942 loan. Despite liberal support, the New Republic denounced the RFC for betraying the West's attempts to build its own steel mills and free itself from control by the East, and innumerable resolutions from chambers of commerce, Kaiser had exhausted his political IOUs. To rub salt in his wounds, the War Assets Administration auctioned the Geneva, Utah mill to U.S. Steel, the lowest bidder, for a mere 25 cents on the dollar of its cost.